mouth, don't you? I thought I forgot to press play.
Okay. Right. So we're going to have three trials before the Jewish authorities and three before the Gentile ones. Can I just give you some cross references to start off tonight? For those who are wanting to make a note, we're going to see that he was first brought before Annas. Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, and though he was not literally the high priest at the time of the Lord's arrest, he nevertheless had great influence and authority, as we shall see. Now, the way he was brought before Annas is described for us in John chapter 18, verse 12 to 24. John 18, verse 12 to 24. Then he is taken from Annas to Caiaphas, who was his son-in-law, who was high priest at this particular time. With Caiaphas were going to be some of the Sanhedrin council. And this is told us in Matthew chapter 26, verse 57 to 66, Mark 14, 53 to 65, Luke 22, verse 55 and 63 to 65, and John 18, verse 28. So that's the trial before Caiaphas and some of the council, Matthew 26, verse 57 to 66, Mark 14, 53 to 65, Luke 22, verse 55 and 63 to 65, and John chapter 18, verse 28. And then the third trial, when he was brought before the full Sanhedrin council and condemned, is in Matthew 27, verse 1, Mark chapter 15, verse 1, Luke 22, verse 66 to 77. Matthew 27, 1, Mark 15, 1, Luke 22, verse 66 to 77. And those were the three trials, or the three interrogations, that were going to take place before these Jewish authorities, before he was taken to Pontius Pilate. Now, intermingled with him being spoken to by Annas and Caiaphas and some of the council, we have the denial by Peter of his Lord. It was all going to take place during these hours of darkness from midnight onwards as these things were being worked out at that particular time. Now, some appreciation of how the movements occurred during this dreadful night. So we want to take the thought up tonight and begin by going to John chapter 18. And reading from verse 12, the band and the captain of the officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him and led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest the same year. Now, just to bring back into your minds the position of Annas and Caiaphas. If we go to Luke's Gospel in chapter 3, in the opening couple of verses, we're given that in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, we have then the various other divisions of the land and the surrounding areas. Philip was tetrarch of Iturea and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias the tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests. Now, Caiaphas was literally the appointed high priest at this time, both in Luke chapter 3 and in John chapter 18. But it mentions here that both Annas and Caiaphas were high priests. If we go to the Acts of the Apostles in chapter 4, we also find that Annas is mentioned in this same context in Acts chapter 4. When the apostles were going to be brought before the council. Look at verse 5 of Acts 4. And it came to pass on the morrow that the rulers and the elders and the scribes, and Annas the high priest, and Caiaphas, and John and Alexander, and as many as were of the kindred of the high priest, were gathered together at Jerusalem. Now if we'd just read that as it appears in the Authorized, we would assume that Annas was again the high priest, this time on his own. But he wasn't again. Caiaphas was still the high priest. In Acts chapter 4, he was not, according to history, he was not removed from the priesthood, the high priesthood, until AD 36 was Caiaphas. And so we've got to reconcile why both Luke and Acts speak of Annas as being the high priest, sometimes with Caiaphas, other times without him. And if we look, for example, at Strong's and just turn up the name Annas, we will find, quite ironically, that his name means humble. So when anybody tries to tell you that the names and the meaning of the names of people in Scripture always have great significance, just remind them of Annas, because he was just the opposite of the meaning of his name. He was certainly not humble. But Strong tells us this, that he was elevated to the high priesthood by the governor of Syria in the year AD 6 or 7. But he was deposed shortly afterwards in AD 15 by a bloke called Gratus, who was a procurator of Judea. And this procurator put in the place of Annas his first son, or his eldest son, who was named Fabi. And so Annas was only literally high priest between AD 6 or 7 and AD 15. He was then replaced by his sons. And in total, he had 5 sons, and each one in turn, not directly following each other, but each one took a period of the high priest. Also included in that was Caiaphas, his son-in-law, who obviously married one of his daughters. And Caiaphas came to be the high priest of Israel at the time of AD 18. But because it was very much a family affair, Annas being the elder and being the patriarch of the family, still exerted great influence over the family. And most people still regarded Annas as the high priest. And that seems to be, according to Strong and the other historians, as to why we have this sort of connection between Annas and Caiaphas. Caiaphas was the actual high priest, but because Annas was the one who had held office before, he was the patriarch, he was the one who exerted great influence, he still was regarded as one of the great authorities, and therefore alongside the high priest of Israel. They resided, as I have said, in the same palace. Annas occupied the one wing and Caiaphas the other wing. It's significant that when the mob bring Jesus back to the palace, he goes first to Annas, which would seem to underline the status that he had even over his son-in-law, the high priest, Caiaphas. Now, when we consider John chapter 18 and the situation of the Lord being brought before Annas, we're told in verse 14, Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one should die for the nation. We've seen that earlier on back in John chapter 11. But it was Annas who was first to interrogate Jesus, And don't forget, he was brought before them that they might sentence him to death. Now, we all know, because we hear it so often, most of the things that were going to go on during this evening or during this night were illegal. First and foremost, Annas had no direct authority. Secondly, if there was a capital punishment situation, it had to be brought before the full council. It couldn't even be looked upon simply by the high priest, which had been Caiaphas. So everything, as we shall go on down the verses, is totally out of order, totally irregular. But nevertheless, it was allowed to continue. Now, as we've said, we've got intermingled in this sort of situation which was going with Annas, the betrayal by the Lord of the Lord by Peter. I'm not going to get sidetracked to deal with that. We dealt with that when we looked at Simon Peter in detail, and we've considered the betrayal of by Peter on numerous occasions. So I'm going to go from verse 14 through to verse 19. And although it says the word the high priest, I would still suggest here it's Annas and not Caiaphas, as we would normally think of him as the high priest. And we've given our reasons as to why Annas is sometimes spoken of as the high priest. So the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. They obviously wanted to see who was with him, what the subversive activities might have been, what was the size of his organisation, who was behind him, who was giving him any support, or whatever the case may be. It's quite normal if you take a ringleader, you want to know else who is involved. And of course they wanted to know what his teaching was, what his doctrine, what was his policy, what was he trying to subvert the people by saying and by teaching. And so the opening sort of interrogation follows the normal sort of pattern. They were looking upon Jesus as a troublemaker. They were trying to obviously accuse him of stirring up wrath and strife, and therefore as an agitator they wanted to see what else and who else was involved. Jesus responded in verse 20. I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me. What have I said unto them? Behold, they know what I said. The Lord had never tried to hide his light under a bushel. He'd never not spoken openly about those things that he had preached, those things that he spoke of. They'd had him watched for virtually 3.5 years. It was not something which had just come overnight and therefore appeared on the scene. On many occasions, as we've seen in the past, they had tried to take him, arrest him, and even on other occasions tried to kill him. Each time he'd escaped out of their hands. There was no way they weren't fully aware of the answer to their own question in verse 19. It's significant that the actual response of the Lord is indicated in prophecy. Can we go back to Isaiah chapter 48? And it would seem that the prophet anticipated even these details of the trial. Because in Isaiah 48, and in verse 16, he says, come ye near unto me, hear this. I have not spoken in secret from the beginning. From the time that it was, there am I, and now the Lord God in his Spirit has sent me. And he goes on to speak about the things that he had said. And so he had not spoken in secret, exactly the same phrase which the Lord uses in verse 20 of John 18. And he says, in secret have I spoken nothing. They'd observed him. They realised fully, so the Lord wasn't avoiding the question, they know jolly well what the answer to it was. And so we have the response in verse 22 that they took his answer to Annas as being something which was very offhand, very impolite, and a rebuke to the high priest. And so in verse 22, when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Answerest thou the high priest so?" You'll notice if you've got a margin, an Oxford version margin anyway, you'll see by the phrase, "with the palm of his hand," we've got the alternative rendering as "with a rod." So rather than a smack across the face, as would be indicated with the palm of his hand, the alternative render in the margin says they smote him with a rod, which obviously would be a far more painful and brutal blow. Strong gives us an either-or situation. He says the Greek word, which is raphsia, can either mean a blow with a rod or a blow with the flat of the hand. So you pay your money and you take your choice. You can either have it as in verse 22 in the text, or as the margin alternative gives it. If you look up all the translations, right from the old ones, the RV and the RSV, right through to the modern ones, you'll find they're split about 50-50. Some will say that he was smitten with the palm of the hand. Some will say that he was smitten with a rod. Because you know your scriptures, brothers and sisters, you'll know which one of the two is right. Because of Micah chapter 5. Because there it was prophesied what would happen to the one who would come out of Bethlehem Ephrata, whose goings were from old, from everlasting, the one who would stand in the strength of the Lord and would be a ruler in Israel. Micah chapter 5 and verse 1 says, "Now gather thyself in troops, O daughter of troops. He hath laid siege against us. Thou shalt smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek." Now we can't be certain that the only time they smote him with the rod was here before Annas, but the irony of verse 1 would seem to be appropriate. Annas was standing there before the Lord as the judge of Israel, the presiding officer, the one who was interrogating the Lord Jesus to put him to death. And yet Micah had prophesied that they were to smite the judge of Israel, not Annas, not Caiaphas, but the Lord Jesus, with a rod upon the cheek. So I would be persuaded on the basis of Micah chapter 5 verse 1 that it wasn't the palm of the hand, it wasn't a smack across the face. They actually took a rod and smote the Lord on the cheek. It's significant when we think of Micah chapter 5 and verse 1, that if he was smitten literally, directly upon the cheek, it brings into play one of his teachings. Shall we go to Matthew chapter 5? Matthew chapter 5 and verse 39, against the background of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The Lord says, "I say unto you," Matthew 5 verse 39, "that you resist not evil, and whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." Now we're not told in John chapter 18 or elsewhere in the Gospels whether the Lord did that, but it would be very interesting to think about it in the context that if Micah 5 verse 1 was literally prophetic, and I would suggest it was, whether verse 39 was an outplaying of some of the actual Lord's teaching. If we just look back at verse 22 of John chapter 18, the reaction of the officer was no doubt that he had spoken out against the high priest. You remember it was a similar accusation later on of which the Apostle Paul was accused. I presume, and again, it may or may not be so, but I presume that they'd got in mind a law from the book of Exodus. Can we go back to Exodus chapter 22? And don't forget, these sundry laws would be very much in the forefront of the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, because they very much were the jot and tittle experts. If there was a law which said you could do thus or so, then they would know it. And Exodus chapter 22 and verse 28, which was the one which was quoted by at the time of Paul in Acts 23, when he says, "Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people." So presumably they were responding to what they thought the Lord had said, that he had basically rebuked the high priest, and therefore he'd reviled the ruler of his people. That was the charge in Acts 23, which they got against the Apostle Paul. If that's the case, and presumably it is, verse 1 of chapter 23 is going to be interesting in the context. "Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness." So if it was going to be the case that they said, "Look, you're guilty of Exodus 22 verse 28 and that's why he was smitten with the rod upon the cheek," we find that later on the Lord is going to be accused by false witnesses. And if we come back to verse 23 of John chapter 18, the Lord actually bears the fact that "if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but if well, why smitest thou me? If I've not cursed or reviled the high priest, if I've spoken evil against him, tell me the evidence of it." And of course they were going to bring the witnesses to show that he had blasphemed both God and the king, or so they thought. And so there's an interesting sort of play going on here before Annas. We find then, as would be appear from verse 24, that now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest, as if what we've read was before Caiaphas. If you look at any other translation, you will find that basically now Annas sent him now bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. So it would seem from this point on in verse 24 that he went from one wing of the palace to the other, from Annas to Caiaphas. All we seem to have about his interrogation by Annas is what we've just read there in John chapter 18. The rest is basically going to be before our friend Caiaphas. But with Caiaphas, I would suggest there was some of the council of the Sanhedrin. As we look at the verses, we're going to see the reason why I'm saying that. I don't believe it was the full council, because they were convened the very early part of the next, beginning of the day, when the daylight appeared. I believe there was just a few of the council, particularly selected by Caiaphas to help him in the accusations that he was going to level to them. Let's just talk a bit about Caiaphas. Again, you know him, and you know him well. Caiaphas, as we've said, was appointed in AD 18 and removed in AD 35-36. So right through most of the latter ministry of the Lord, and certainly in the early part of the apostles, it was this Caiaphas who was the high priest. According to Strong, his name means comely. which again is a bit of a paradox. There's nothing very becoming about our friend Caiaphas. Now, according to the Mosaic law, no one could aspire to the high priesthood unless they were of the family of Aaron, of the tribe of Levi. But of course that had long since disintegrated. And from the time of the Maccabees, then it was not that process by which the high priest was selected. And from that time onwards, it became very much in a political appointment. I suppose in some ways, so it is today, where the government has to approve our Archbishop of Canterbury. But in these days, it was very much done at the behest of the governors who ruled the particular land of Israel under the Roman authority. As we said, that Annas was appointed by the governor of Syria, and Caiaphas was appointed by the governor of Judea. So they were very much political appointments, and obviously if they upset the governor, then they were removed from office and somebody else was put in the position. You also recall that the high priesthood under the Mosaic system, once they were appointed the high priest, remained in that position until death. Whereas the priests and the Levites had certain times in which they could serve and then they were removed from office after a certain age, the high priest remained throughout his life after the appointment. But that was not the case by this time. And Strong tells us that during the 107 years between the time of Herod the Great, which was BC 37, and the destruction of the Holy City in AD 70, 28 persons held the office of the high priest. So in 107 years, 28 people were appointed as high priests, of which 7 were Annas and his family. So he had quite a chunk of influence during those 107 years, of which there were 28 different high priests of Israel. Now when you consider from AD 6 through to about AD 40, his family held sway. That's quite a proportion of the time, but it just shows how high priests were appointed and disposed at the whim and the fancy of the governors of the land. Now we all know about the Sanhedrin Council, the 70 plus 1 members who made up the Great Council of Jerusalem. They were the prominent members of society and of course some of the family of the high priest themselves. Again, for those of you who want to look it up, just look up Strong. He gives you a lot of details about the Sanhedrin. The things which are interesting as far as our consideration at the moment is concerned, there were strict rules, as we could imagine, governing the Sanhedrin Council. I mean, it's bad enough in the Brotherhood, isn't it? With our constitution saying we've got to have so many for a quorum and we can have so much notice if we want a special meeting and so on and so forth. So it's bad enough amongst brothers and sisters, but we can imagine with the legislative sort of thinking of these great men, then there were very, very strict rules governing what could or could not be done. You had to have 23 members for a quorum. No capital punishment charge could be passed or even heard without 40 days notice being given. So if they wanted someone charged for a capital offence, i.e. to be put to death, they had to allow 40 days time to elapse for the man or the woman to allow them to have a defence, and also for the Sanhedrin to meet. they could not sit on a feast day. And they could not sit except between the hours of the morning and evening sacrifice. 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Nine till three, not on a feast day, they'd have 40 days notice for defence. And the man was alleged to be innocent unless he could prove without reasonable doubt that he was guilty. The man had no need to defend himself. If they could not bring sufficient proof and evidence to show that he was guilty, then he was declared innocent and released. The full council had to sit before a capital charge could be confirmed. And the death penalty had to be endorsed by the Roman governor, and there had to be at least 24 hours after the council found them guilty before he could be put to death. And these laws were laid down almost in stone for the Sanhedrin Council, and yet virtually every solitary one of them was ignored, broken, abused at the time of the Lord. And no doubt there might have been more, but yeah, these are relevant as I've sort of gone through the books on the actual trial of Jesus. I'm sure most of you have read Who've Moved the Stone by Morrison. He obviously gives some ideas, but these are just taken from the reference books. So basically, it would seem that, first of all, they shouldn't have met during the hours of darkness. Secondly, they couldn't meet on a feast day. Thirdly, they could only meet between certain times. And fourthly, more importantly, 40 days should have elapsed from when he was charged before the trial. And so the whole thing was a travesty of justice, even according to Jewish law. The reason I suggest he, when he was brought to Caiaphas, there were others there at the time, is because of things that we read of. Can we just go back to Matthew's Gospel now for a moment? And Matthew chapter 26. Matthew 26, you'll notice in verse 57, and they that laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and elders were assembled. We find that in verse 59, now the chief priests and elders and all the council saw false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Now, it's obvious that the full council were to meet the next morning, because in verse 1 of chapter 27, when the morning was come, all the chief priests and the elders took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And we're going to look at other gospel records, and you will find that there seems to be, although it says all in verse 59, and no doubt all the council were trying to bring false witness, I don't think they were all in the sense that they all wanted to condemn him to death. I don't believe Gamaliel wanted to condemn him to death. I don't think Nicodemus would want him to condemn him to death. I don't think Joseph of Arimathea would want to condemn him to death. And so it's like when all the world was going to be taxed, or all the world was going to be destroyed. It's, you know, not necessarily meaning every single one of them. And I would suggest here that with the high priest, at this particular interrogation, was just a few, and whether it was a quorum, I haven't a clue. I think it was a few of his cronies who were assisting him to try and condemn the Lord to death. When they moved from Caiaphas, they were taken to the temple, to the full council of the Sanhedrin, and that is when the sentence was passed. I'd like to take up the thoughts by going to Mark's account, Mark chapter 14. And again, we shall see this first of all in Mark chapter 14. And verse 53. And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. And then Peter followed into the place, and as I say, we had the denial by Peter at the same time. Verse 55 says, and the chief priests and all the council sought witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, and said, we have heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and with 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither so did their witness agree together. Now, the incredible thing, obviously, which shouts to any of us reading these, as we've read many times, is the attempts they made to try and find witnesses to testify against the Lord. But they couldn't agree. None of their witnesses held together. Now, if you just go back to an earlier incident, although we're going on in our Bibles, when Judas agreed to betray the Lord. Can we go back to Luke 22? We commented at this at the time that the chief priests and the elders had already convened together to try and find a means whereby they might kill Jesus. Verse 1, the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover, and the chief priests and scribes thought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Then Satan entered into Judas, surnamed Iscariot, being one of the number of the 12, and he went his way and communed with the high priests and captains, how he might betray him unto them. So the chief priests and the elders had already tried to find many ways of taking the Lord, and then, as it were, an answer to their prayer was Judas coming in their midst and showing how that they could take the Lord and he would betray him. And verse 5 says, and they were glad and comforted it to him to give him money. Now, again, as we commented at the time, and I think it's fairly obvious from just reading this, they've got the right, inverted commas, and they certainly got the power to have taken Jesus off the scene if they had wanted to, from a natural point of view. They've got the guards, they've got power where the governor would allow them to imprison a person for a fairly lengthy time, as we find again with Paul, there was agitation in any sense of the term, then they could be taken off the scene and the governor wouldn't really argue because he didn't want any problems and he didn't want any uprising whatsoever. So when they communed with Judas, and they were glad in what he told them, they obviously weren't glad that he told them where Jesus was. They obviously weren't necessarily glad that he said, I'll devise a way in which you can take him. They could have come up with a way of taking him. They must have been glad of how in verse 2 they might kill him. And so what they were glad about was what Judas could come up with to prove that they had got a very undisputable case to put the Lord to death. So Judas had obviously got the answer of how he could be condemned in front of the people, that it would be endorsed by the Roman authorities, and they'd get rid of Jesus. Now, we tend to think that Judas had led them to where the Lord was, and that's why, in that sense, he had betrayed him. But that's just a very feeble understanding of this, because they knew where Jesus was most of the time. They knew where, he didn't try and hide himself, he didn't do things in secret, as we have seen. So it would seem that Judas had given them cast iron evidence of how they might witness against Jesus to put him to death. So why now do they need false witnesses? They had paid him 30 pieces of silver. Whether that was the full amount or a down payment, matters not. Judas had agreed they had paid the money of how Jesus might be betrayed. And yet when we come back to Matthew chapter 14, the absence of Judas is glaring. He was there in the garden. He had kissed the Lord. Hail, Master. They had dragged him to Annas. No mention of Judas. They had dragged him to Caiaphas. No mention of Judas. The next thing we're going to read of Judas is when he repented of the evil that he had done. So where was Judas? Where was their key witness? Why hadn't they got the witness that they wanted to condemn the Lord to death? Put that in your minds for a moment. Let's say they needed more than the witness of Judas. It would seem from the law, as we know, between two and three witnesses shall all matters be established. So even if they'd got Judas to give them the information what they wanted, they'd got to have others who would collaborate with him. Because again, if the Lord wanted to, which he wouldn't have done, but if he wanted to, he'd say that in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall all matters be established. One witness on his own is not necessarily proof positive that these things are so. Now the disciples obviously may have been taken by surprise with what happened, but the Lord wasn't. He knew the intent to why Judas had left the room and gone out to get the soldiers and the guards and things like that. He knew exactly what was going to happen. But so did Caiaphas. He was party to it. He paid money for it to happen. He must have arranged all of this, what was going on in the night, because it couldn't have just happened. The very fact that Annas and he were still up in the middle of the night would have been a rare event with Passover the next day. The very fact that he finds Pilate there willing to see Jesus early morning, we're talking about from 6 or 7 o'clock, was quite an incredible situation for a Roman governor on feast day. And so the whole thing, and we're going to give you verses to prove it in a few moments, was prearranged. The whole thing was a setup. So why couldn't the witnesses agree? Even if their witness was false, and you could get two men, three men, pay them sufficient money, school them, train them, tell them what to say, and you get them to agree. One says the one thing, the other endorses it, and the third one agrees with them. It wasn't beyond the powers of a high priest, and he certainly wasn't beyond the power of the elders of the time, to find sufficient people to collaborate their evidence together. But they didn't. I wonder why that was. I wonder why they could not agree. You'd normally expect them to have been convincing, even if it was a pack of lies. But they weren't even convincing. Can we go back to the Old Testament now? Can we just put one or two things together? Psalm 27, first of all. Psalm 27. Verse 12. Deliver me not over unto the will of mine enemies, for false witnesses are risen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. That's a verse we tend to read in connection with this thing of Judas. Can I go to Psalm 35? Can we read from verse 11? And with your permission, brethren and sisters, I'd like to read from verse 11 through to the end of the psalm. And if you could, while I'm reading it through, think of this situation that one witness after another was brought before him, and they could not agree on their testimony, and they could not agree on the things that they were saying. Verse 11, Psalm 35. False witnesses did rise up. They laid to my charge things that I knew not. They rewarded me evil for good, to the spoiling of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled myself with fasting, and my prayer returned unto mine own bosom. I behaved myself as though he had been my friend or brother. I bowed heavily, as one that mourneth for his mother. But in my adversity they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. Yea, the abjects that gathered themselves together against me, and I knew it not, they did tear me and cease not. With hypocritical mockers in feasts they gnashed upon me with their teeth. Lord, how long wilt thou look on? Rescue my soul from their destruction, my darling from the lions. I will give thee thanks in the great congregation. I will praise thee among much people. Let not them that are mine enemies wrongfully rejoice over me. Neither let them wink with the eye that hate me without a cause. For they speak not peace, but they devise deceitful matters against them that are quiet in the land. Yea, they have opened their mouths wide against me and said, Aha, aha, our eye has seen it. This thou hast seen, O Lord. Keep not silence, O Lord. Be not far from me. Stir up thyself and awake to my judgment, even to my cause, my Lord and my God. Judge me, O Lord, my God, according to thy righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. Let them not say in their hearts, Ah! So would we have it. Let them not say, We have swallowed them up. Let them be ashamed and brought to confusion together that rejoice at mine height. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonour that magnify themselves against me. Let them shout for joy and be glad that favour my righteous cause. Yea, let them say continually, The Lord be magnified, which hath pleasure in the prosperity of his servant. And my tongue shall speak of thy righteousness and thy praise all the day long. Now if these verses and thoughts are in essence a comment on what was going on at the time, that these false witnesses, the enemies, were brought up against him. I'm not suggesting at all that it has got reference, that it hasn't got reference to other times in the Lord's life, but it seems very appropriate of the very wording and thought here of false witnesses and the way that it is carried forward to this trial. That there are two specific things which come out loud and clear. Number one, that he knew them. That they were rendering evil for good, that he must have helped them. He says, you know, I humble myself with fasting. When they were sick, I went to their aid. So it would seem that there were people who had accompanied him, at least for a time, during his ministry. And they were saying things which he was not aware of, that I knew not. Things that I was not knowing. But secondly, brothers and sisters, I would suggest that the Lord had prayed that their council would not agree together. That the high priest of Israel would not have just cause by the evidence of these witnesses to condemn him. And it would seem in verse 25, for example, let them not say in their hearts, ah, would we have had it? Let them not say we have swallowed him up. He didn't want them to be the means whereby the high priest could hang the sort of conviction upon them. He wanted them to condemn him out of their own mouth. And so verse 26 seems to come into play. Let them be ashamed and brought to confusion that rejoice at mine hurt. And I would say the Almighty overrode their testimony like he had done with Balaam in the past and like he can do on any occasion. And it was not going to be those witnesses who could testify against the Lord so that they could hang the charge upon him. The Lord wanted a different means whereby they were going to condemn him to death, and it was not going to be these witnesses. And try as they might, and if we come back to Mark chapter 14, notice it was not one occasion, and this was premeditated, as we're going to have a look at in a second. It was not on one occasion, but it was on a number of occasions that these things were brought against him. Mark chapter 14. Look, verse 55. The chief priests and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus, but found none. For many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we've heard him say this. But neither in verse 57 could their witness agree together. So one after another, various ones were brought in. None of them succeeded in collaborating together against the Lord. And I would suggest the psalm gives us the answer. Because, let's be fair, whatever they wanted to accuse him of, it wouldn't be difficult to get two or three to agree. I'm not saying it would have been true, I'm not saying it would have been genuine, but it could have been convincing. If you pay me enough money, I can put a convincing argument up, and I'm sure I could find some friends who would agree with me, and a sum for one. Well, that's right. And therefore, we've got to think beyond that they just didn't know what they were saying. There must have been reasons, and I would suggest that the psalm gives us that appreciation. If we can just flick back to the prophets this time. I'd like to have a look at as to why we're suggesting that the whole thing was a put-up. Can we go back to Micah chapter 7? Before we go to Micah, can I go back to the Psalms? I was going to go to the Psalms and I decided not, but I'd still like to go to the Psalms first. Psalm 31, if you don't mind. Sorry about that. Psalm 31. Verse 13, I have heard the slander of many. Fear was on every side, while they took counsel together against me. They devised to take away my life. But I trusted in thee, O Lord, I said, thou art my God. And so there was fear amongst them. They couldn't get these witnesses to agree. But the Lord says, they took counsel against me. They devised to take away my life. Now bring that to Micah chapter 7. And again, all we can do is try and piece together a few hints and ideas that we're given in the Old Testament scriptures to try and piece together some of the details which lie beneath the verses of the gospel records. Micah chapter 7. I'm going to go straight into verse 3. Verse 2, I suppose, we ought to give a connection. The good man is perished out of the earth. There is none upright among them. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net. That they may do evil, with both hands earnestly, the prince asketh, and the judge asketh for reward, and the great men, he uttereth his mischievous desire, so they wrap it up. Keep your finger there, brothers and sisters, and go to Acts of the Apostles. And to chapter 4. Verse 26. The kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For of a truth, against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles, and the people of Israel, were gathered together, for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy and counsel determined before to be done. And now, Lord, behold their threatenings, and grant unto thy servant that with all boldness, etc., etc. The Apostle Peter here quotes Psalm 2, as we know. And he speaks of the kings of the earth and the rulers going against the Lord of his Christ as being Herod, Pontius Pilate, the people of Israel, and those who were seeking counsel to put him to death. I'm suggesting that as well as Psalm 2, which we'd normally understand in a totally different context to Acts 4, we would normally put Psalm 2 in the kingdom, when the Lord has established his king upon his holy hill of Zion, and yet the Apostle Peter, under inspiration, applies it to the time of the Lord's trial, obviously foreshadowing that which is to come. I'm suggesting Micah chapter 7 might have a connection. I'm going to put some names to these phrases in verse 3. That they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asketh. I'm going to suggest the prince was Herod. Because Herod wanted a sign from the Lord, as we shall see when we get to him. But the judge, and I'm going to suggest that the judge, obviously, was the Roman procurator Pilate, and he asked for reward. And the great man, I'm going to suggest, is the high priest. He uttereth his mischievous desire, so between them they wrap it up. And I reckon all this was predetermined. And they had bribed Pilate to appear so early in the morning. And they had caused this lead this net to be woven to snare the Lord. Now I know we normally understand Micah chapter 7 in a totally different way altogether. I'm using Psalm 2 and Acts 4 as the basis that we are allowed from time to time, to see these things perhaps in a different context as well. And I would suggest that there have been a lot of behind-the-scenes activity. There have been bribes and promises and all good sort of things, because the one thing Herod wanted above all was to see Jesus, and he wanted a sign from him. Pilate, you know, was a typical Roman governor. He would do anything if he could, thought he could gain out of it. And it was Caiaphas and Annas who wanted the Lord put to death. And yet their false witnesses had failed. And I believe it was because the Lord had confused their testimony. Because that wasn't the way he was going to be condemned to death. Judas was totally absent. And so we're going to find next time, God willing, perhaps why that was, and look at it in detail, go through the things which Caiaphas and the council accuse him of, and then, as he's taken forward between Pilate and condemned to death. And again, we shall try and piece some of the Old Testament together to try and give us a bit more matter which goes behind the scenes. So we'll leave it there at this point.